The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 7, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Great to be practicing here with you all on this pretty cold morning, I think. A bit colder than yesterday. Today, I wanted to investigate the Heart Sutra a little bit. I had been thinking about looking into a bit of the Shobo Genzo, too. So this is book one of four of Dogen's fascicles of the Shobo Genzo, which is basically commentary on all kinds of different sutras and teachings. I mean, it's a combination of Dogen's commentary, but then also his expounding of his own, different teachings of his own in there. But there's at the very beginning of the Shobo Genzo, we have, I think it's Bendoa, and then the second one is on the Heart Sutra. So I'll be blending Dogen's writing here and comments in with the sutra itself, sort of explore that a little bit. I think a lot of you are familiar with the Heart Sutra, so feel free to chime in if there's something of interest that you want to talk about. So the title of Dogen's piece is Maka Hana Haramitsu, which is the perfection of great wisdom. You hear that title as well when we chant the Heart Sutra every day in session, the great perfection of wisdom, Heart Sutra. So that's what the title is. And that caught my attention pretty much right away. In thinking about particularly the perfection of wisdom, that would be prajna paramita. So prajna is wisdom, and then paramita is perfection. And in looking at this, I noticed that those are reversed, and maybe our Sanskrit expert, I suppose maybe the language sentence structure is formulated a little bit differently sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. In Sanskrit, it's not uncommon to take a set of words and smush them all together.
Okay.
And make a long thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they lop off the endings.
Okay.
So the order doesn't matter.
Oh, the order doesn't matter.
But when you reconstruct it, you have to figure out what the endings would have been based on context.
Oh, okay. So prajna paramita literally would be perfection wisdom, but we say it the other way around. But that title caught my attention, particularly in how the sutra talks about the perfection of wisdom in the sense that I think when we hear a term like perfection or wisdom, it has maybe a feeling of maybe an attainable thing. Or we think about wisdom in a lot of cases in our culture, that would be, you know, something that we're aspiring to, or as a certain characteristic that we may get at some point. Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of what Steve was saying too in his class or in his talk yesterday here at Sesshin. The notion of what Sesshin is can be pretty defined as well. So we'll think of that is something that we're going to, you know, something that we're going to, have an experience of one type or another, maybe it'd be that blissful experience or the anti-blissful experience. It could show up in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's sort of mixing and changing and transforming as we sit for an extended period of time. But I particularly liked, and Steve has great intros to his session talks and the way he talks about session, about this is our complete activity together as a group. That's what session is, not something particular, like an event that we'll be going through that's sitting out there sort of as its own particular thing. And I was reflecting on that and how we think of the perfection of wisdom as well. Sort of, again, similar to session is the sun coming up. You know, it's dark when we start, and then now we'll notice the light fading in, and then sometimes, especially in winter, you'll have an electric blue sky there, and then the sun is setting. So it's this continual experience. And perfection, the perfection of wisdom, I think we can sort of get that feeling as well about the perfection of wisdom, that this is maybe we could say a constant perfectioning. You know, perfection of wisdom is a type of activity. You know, it's an aliveness, basically. It's not something, like I was saying before, an attainable. So perfection is this complete working, or wisdom is actually this complete working. And it's not different from really paying attention to experience. That's what perfection of wisdom is. It's, think of maybe the ripples on water are all affecting each other. There's this balance and uniformity of the whole picture. So that's what perfection of wisdom. It's not a static thing. It's an activity. It's a complete working. There's never a specific endpoint. Whenever the Olympics come around, I think we've got Winter Olympics this year, so that was one thing that sort of popped into my mind. You could think of, pretty easily think of the perfection of wisdom as sort of the Olympic gold version of whatever practice is, you know, that end point, standing on the podium type of thing. But this is, when we look at the sutra, what's actually said in here, it points to something very different than that. And it's funny, you'll read the sutra, or at least I do, and then I'll kind of just read over something and not really notice what it's saying. But it says here that Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom, is, you know, particularly different feel than the notion of perfection of wisdom being us standing on the podium, you know, with the gold or whatever. The sutra is talking about practicing deeply. And that's what perfection of wisdom, we're actually practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom. Wisdom, I think, again, that's, you know, we hear so many stories about, say, a wise one. Is it King Solomon, the one who had two mothers who were claiming the same child and cut the child in half? So it's a story of the king that has this wisdom. You know, it's something you can develop, and once you have it, then you can make these wise decisions. But I think here, with this different inflection with the sutra, it's wisdom is more like, you know, maybe the image of a sail on a sailboat that's finely tuned, but it's being tuned over time and it's responsive to the wind. So it's not, you know, the set, solidified thing. It's, again, akin to sort of what I've been talking about so far. It's alive and it's active. we get this other glimmers of this in the sutra as well, when we talk about the Avalokiteshvara depending on the perfection of wisdom, which is basically just to resume awareness right here now. That's what we do in session. Avalokiteshvara is a figure who gazes down at the world. So it's the bodhisattva of infinite compassion. And she is this figure that is hearing the cries of the world, who is responsive to the arising of whatever's happening, and does not actually respond specifically to individuals. This is a figure that is embodying the whole itself. So there's not a individual response in the sense that in the teachings we see that there's a continual emphasis on not self. So Avalokiteshvara's compassion is a compassion of totality, of responsive. So it's basically an undivided response of the whole to the whole. And it's a little hard to kind of get a sense of this, but I think there's images, you know, just even the image of the earth, how the earth isn't responding specifically. You know, it's not addressing concerns that may appear to be arising. It's completely manifesting in this total support. So you see the natural world working in that way. Dogen actually talks about Avalokiteshvara as prajna itself. He also talks about Avalokiteshvara as the whole body. So you have, in Dogen's writing, this continual expanding of how we may think of terms that we run across, Avalokiteshvara or prajna. Dogen's always allowing that to be more diffuse so we can see this whole picture, pointing back to this full manifestation of reality. Avalokiteshvara is referred to as the bodhisattva of free reflection. And again, so it's not only Dogen that is providing this imagery and this way of talking about things that is has an expansive feel to it. So the bodhisattva of free reflection. And if we hear about that, it may be kind of like, what exactly is that? But I think that's the point of it in some ways, that it's elusive feeling to us, which is helpful because then it's harder to grasp after, you know, defined idea of what Avalokiteshvara is. So this is, you know, the bodhisattva of free reflection. I know, I haven't seen one in a while, but one that's really cold, and it's a cold night with a full moon. Sometimes you'll see a ring around the moon, the lunar halo, I think it is. Maybe a few of you have seen that. So ice crystals in the air capture the light from the moon and then reflect it back. So the moon is there, and then there's this perfect halo around that. And you have this reflection of light that's not graspable. This halo that's there, it's seen differently from different perspectives. It's capturing perfectly the manifestation of what's happening, but we can't grasp it. It's not possible. Yet here it is. And that's how reality shows up. So the Bodhisattva of free reflection, I think, is a bit like that. The world is perfectly reflecting this perfection of wisdom. So, as the sutra says, the Bodhisattva practices and depends on the perfection of wisdom. And here, depending, sometimes is actually translated as abiding. So I think that depending maybe gets us a little bit closer to a type of practice. So this deep practice is depending or trusting what is right in front of us. So we're practicing deeply, and it's just a trust in experience. And in the case of Sesshin, that's just doing one thing at a time. So deeply practicing when we wash our hands and we dry our hands with the cloth. That can be a deep practice, and in terms of tying it in with the sutra, I think this is what the depending is talking about. So it's just trusting the experience. We're doing this one activity, and the Bodhisattva practices that. It's this one exact activity. Dogen, in his usual way, deepens things for us in his reading of the Heart Sutra. So he'll talk about different sections there. He brings up a different sutra as well. I'll touch on that just a little bit. But Dogen says, when prajna is preached and realized, it is form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And then also, Dogen says that prajna is the five aggregates. And this is fairly common sort of formulation for how Dogen presents things. And again, it's in line with this expansive feel to how the teachings are being presented. So he says, prajna is the five aggregates. And as a, just a quick reminder of the five aggregates, when we look at those, that itself is a very elusive teaching. It's a teaching that's meant to talk about how self shows up, but actually self is not something solid, not something graspable. So the five skandhas talk about form, split up into form, the mental and the physical. And when it talks about the physical body, it avoids how we would normally talk about the physical thing in terms of like a self. So it talks about the physical as being the experience of hot or cold, or getting stung by a mosquito is another example. So it's talking about the physical in terms of just experience. And it's not saying that it's the experience of the specific self. And it does as well with sensations. That's also very soft and elusive description of sensations. It's talked about just as a very nuanced or background kind of flavor of positive, negative, or neutral. So not necessarily sensing a podium or something like that. So that's how you see the five skandhas show up. It's describing how the self seems to appear, and it does so in a way that does not use self exactly. So it's this very elusive or ungraspable. It tends towards sort of an ungraspable way of presenting that. So Dogen says that prajna is the five aggregates. When we run across the Heart Sutra, particularly maybe when we first run across it, but I think if we don't really study it closely, it can have a pretty strong kind of singular flavor of all the no's in there. So we think of Heart Sutra and you think, okay, no, 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 no. But there's actually a lot of other things in here. Like that line that Avalokiteshvara is practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom and perceives that all five skandhas are empty. So perceives, experiences directly emptiness itself. And then also says emptiness. So this is, there's no no's in here necessarily. This is kind of a different section. It says emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness is form. So part here, the little excerpt, is talking about direct experience of emptiness. And emptiness does not differ from form, which is actually, it doesn't really have that no flavor to it, but it's speaking of the same thing. That which is emptiness is form. That which is form is emptiness. A little bit later, we have dharmas do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase or decrease. And in Dogen's commentary, he immediately after that, after you see this, dharmas do not appear nor disappear, he says that this is the hundreds of things, the myriad phenomena. So he's pulling this teaching, dharmas do not appear, and he says that this is all things and all phenomena. Which seems like it's kind of doesn't fit together somehow, you know? We hear non-appearing, non-disappearing, not tainted nor pure. Maybe it feels like it's negating the world. But Dogen's saying that is rocks, pebbles, trees, tiles. This non-appearing, non-disappearing is precisely the relative world as it shows up. Yeah, a little bit later also, in line with these aspects of the Heart Sutra that aren't necessarily the no kind of section of the sutra. I think that's how it can... it seems like that, doesn't it? And it's, that's why, looking at these other parts, they fit very well with the no sensation, no eyes, so forth. And then later, it says no attainment, with nothing to attain. Let's see here. Get the line exactly.
Bodhisattva depends on the perfection of wisdom, and the mind is no hindrance.
Yeah, no hindrance. So this attaining wisdom, or wisdom is not an attainable thing, kind of as we were looking at a little bit before. It's not an intrinsic characteristic. And as well, perfection, as we were looking at before, perfection is this completed working, and wisdom is this completed working. So nothing to attain the bodhisattva depends on the perfection of wisdom, and the mind is no hindrance. Nothing to attain, and the mind is no hindrance. I was thinking a little bit about Steve's talk yesterday too, where we may hear about, he was saying that we may hear about before thinking and then get the impression that that's kind of better. You know, there's sort of assumptions that we can kind of hang on to. And then he clarified that it is, that's not what it's speaking of. But here, it's the same exact teaching talking about the mind is no hindrance. So this is a reiteration that thinking is not something negative or bad. The mind is actually no hindrance. And we, Avalokiteshvara is perceiving this directly by depending on the perfection of wisdom. So depending or trusting what is straightforward, you know, whatever our experience is, seeing that lunar halo, just allowing experience to be what it is. This is just to depend on awareness. So in session, we're training our focus on what is unquestionable. And that means we're sitting down and thoughts are coming and going and it's undeniable. Of course, we may have different views of what we think ideas are. We may kind of think of them as something pretty particular and solid, something that drives belief or something like that. But we could probably loosen our ideas about what we think ideas are and allow this just to be experience itself. And in doing so, then we can open the door to understanding no hindrance. So thoughts arising and ceasing like clouds, they're actually not obscuring the sky. So thoughts arising and ceasing like clouds, thinking is not obscuring anything. To attend to them directly is to see through them. So there's no problem with thinking at all. Again, very much similar to what Steve was saying yesterday. And then for the section that talks about, it starts with the skandhas and then the senses or the dhatus. So no sensation, no conception, no eyes, no realm of eyes, and the Four Noble Truths, so no Four Noble Truths, no suffering. So the no's here, we get just trying to think how Dogen... actually, maybe that's just a little bit later here. But this part, which is talking about no eyes, no ears, so forth, ties in perfectly with what we've been speaking about before, the deeply practicing. And actually, I'll get into that a little bit in just a little bit here. Dogen brings in a different sutra that I just talk about that very briefly here. This is a sutra, and it doesn't cite where it's from, I'm not sure exactly, but it talks about a practitioner, a bhikkhu, who is reflecting quietly to themselves. And in that sutra, It talks about, although there is no appearance and no disappearance, the practitioner is reflecting that there is still, as the sutra says, understandable explanations, or we could say that there is still the expounding of different teachings. So no appearance, no disappearance, or you could say this section of no eyes, no ears. With this teaching, there's actually still full expounding of all of those things that are seemingly negated. It's a little, when you read the different translations, you hear different formulations. So one is understandable explanations, the other is expounding or established as experience. So this no appearance, no disappearance is itself the aspects that we were talking about, you know, in this section, Four Noble Truths, so forth. In the sutra, it talks about that they are the three treasures, wisdom and liberation. So, in other words, not to get turned around too much, but the sutra is putting this phrase up here, no appearance, no disappearance. Although that is the way things are, we shouldn't misconstrue that there are somehow not these other things. Actually, no appearance, no disappearance are these aspects that are seemingly negated in here. So it's a pretty interesting sutra. And the Buddha replies at some point and says, this is how it is. The profound prajnaparamita is too subtle and fine to fathom. So you have a sutra which is saying non-appearance, non-disappearance is the Four Noble Truths. And then the Buddha is saying that this is difficult to fathom. All of which is helping us, I think, hear the teachings and helping us not grasp onto them. It's a pretty difficult sutra in some ways. But it's interesting to think about sutras that are pretty deep sounding, you know, saying this non-appearance, non-disappearance is the five skandhas, it's the Four Noble Truths, so forth. But if you think of the lunar halo, and then you try to grasp that, you try to define that, we'll find the same exact subtle, unfathomable experience. If we try to pin anything down, we'll run into the same unfathomable quality. It's any aspect of our life completely unfathomable. When you see a dead bird, you've ever picked up a dead bird and seen those translucent feathers, and it just is inconceivable what you're looking at, the beauty and the detail there. And then maybe we'll see a bird fly from a branch at that same moment. And it's, you know, these experiences, it's completely unfathomable. It is incredible, is completely beyond description. So it's speaking of the same sense that we can get here, that when we see no here, this is unfathomable, is what it's saying.
Not just difficult to conceive, but impossible.
Yeah, and impossible, not in its usual way, but impossible in a good way. Because we could hear not possible. If like an Olympic athlete heard it's not possible to get a gold, that would be pretty discouraging. But here it's like a very different application of unattainable. You know, it's that's freedom itself, that we don't actually need to strive to get something. It's all perfectly here. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Your quote of the Buddha said, difficult. And that's what I
mean. Okay.
It's not just difficult.
Yeah. It's, let's see, what was it? This is my spot here. Subtle, he says. Subtle. It's too subtle and fine to fathom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank
you. Yeah. And Dogen elaborates on this sutra a little bit, which I thought I'd bring up, because there's a particular beauty to it. So he's referring back to the sutra where this practitioner is reflecting or thinking closely about the teachings. And Dogen reformulates this, and I'm going to have to read this. I had to use a couple different translations to kind of make this work for how I understood it. And this is going to sound, you know, pretty, with a bit of poetic type of flavor to it, but, Dogen talks about this practitioner, and talks about the secretly working thus mind. So again, this is referring to that sutra where the practitioner is secretly or quietly recognizing non-appearance, non-arising, non-ceasing. Dogen says, this is secretly working thus mind. Sincerely honoring true form. With venerative respect, the practitioner feels this is non-appearance, non-disappearance, and recognizes prajna. So, perhaps this ties back to earlier when we look at the prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom, being completely alive, you know, full activity. And I feel like the secretly working thus mind. So you can see a practitioner in how it very much shows up for us. You know, we're sitting in a room. We can't just, like, say that that doesn't exist. There's nothing solid or persisting about those descriptions. There's nothing absolutely true about them, but that's how it shows up. And Dogen is portraying that to us in a very lyrical way, the secretly working thus mind and honoring true form, which is a term that you'll run across with Dogen sometimes when he's talking about rocks, pebbles, and trees. He'll describe that as true form, which is, there's some sections where he'll say that, and immediately after that, he'll say that it's, you know, it can't be found, it's not permanent. So he's talking about true form, which is unfathomable reality. It doesn't, you know, we can't land on any absolute description, of course, of anything. There's nothing of substance behind what's appearing. Let's see. Keep losing my spot. And then also, again, sort of this beauty lyric phrase here talks about venerative respect. The practitioner feels this. as non-appearance, non-disappearance. Partially this is kind of my way of reformulating it. It's, if you read both translations of this particular little section here, they're very different. And I recognize this as prajna, and I was feeling that maybe something underneath this recognizing is kind of like recognizing a friend type of feel to it. Sort of a warmth of knowing what's familiar. A bit later in the sutra, we see Avalokiteshvara perceiving emptiness. And right at the beginning there, right along with that, is being saved from suffering. And this ties into what we find later in the sutra about nothing to attain. We talked about this just a little bit. So reading that beginning, perceiving all five skandhas are empty, is being saved from all suffering and distress. And again, this ties in with the realization of nothing to attain. No attainment. With nothing to attain, the bodhisattva depends on the perfection of wisdom. So recognizing that there's nothing that we attain, which is similar kind of what we were talking about a second ago, no striving and struggling is needed. We don't need to try to attain something. We can actually set aside the struggle that is actually, the deeply practicing, recognizing emptiness is to recognize non-attainment, and therefore the struggle of attainment is just naturally set aside. There's a very natural peace, you know, it's all of one piece, basically, this deep practice. There's a couple terms that they're not in this particular fascicle, but you'll run across two Japanese, I believe, terms, mu and u. And mu and u. Yeah, mu and u. And you'll see the mu in the famous koan about does a dog have Buddha nature? And is it Joshu, I think, replies mu. Which mu, and have you heard these terms before? Yeah. Mu is translated to, I like this one, it's not, with an exclamation point. So it's, you know, has this emphasis to it. Not, non, or without. And maybe these are definitions that are very highly tuned to Buddhist teaching too, so I don't know if maybe these terms are used in general parlance too, but here at least the refinement to Buddhist teaching would be mu is non, and then u is yes, which I like too, you know, the emphasis or the feeling of this. So not, with exclamation point, I think it communicates somebody who, you know, Avalokiteshvara, who understands this, and with the prospect of considering whether there's substance to the world, it's not, you know, definitive, helping us to see. And then also, u is yes, or presence, which I think is Dogen saying tiles, rocks, trees, the lunar halo. Are we going to dismiss that? You know, we're just off in another, we're winding down the path of some strange speculative philosophy if we are negating how the myriad phenomena shows up. So you have mu and u together, not as a duality, but actually an honoring of both emptiness and form at the same time. So it's yes, of course. This is showing up, a complete honoring. So when we see the no in the Heart Sutra, maybe it seems like no is almost like outer space, you know, just vacuousness or something, as opposed to a rock, you know, that's solid. And maybe at first glance, mu seems like the outer space, vacuousness, and u is the rock, the solid thing. But it's not material versus immaterial. It's mu and u. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. The same true, deep reflection on just the way it is. So mu is fully functioning, complete reflection, as u, as yes. We hear sound or the light hitting the floor. It's undeniable, but it's not substantial. The sutra ends with a couple different parts here. Dogen brings in, I think, a continuation of the sutra that was referred to earlier. And Indra, actually, this might be a slightly different sutra, so there's a couple in there. And there's a couple of characters in this sutra. One of them is Indra. Another is Subhuti, and the Buddha is involved as well. So Indra is the king of devas in Buddhist cosmology. And this is, as any other kind of archetype, you might say, of Buddhism, Avalokiteshvara or mana, which is a representation of desire or, basically desire. Indra is similar, although this is a Hindu god. So it's a Hindu god that's brought into the sutra. But this is the king of devas. This is the deva who is responsible for weather and lightning, rain and thunder, and probably lunar halos too, I guess, probably, kind of weather-related aspects. But I think it's touching when you see these devas coming into sutras. And in this case, Indra is a protector of humanity as well. So this image of the protector of humanity, and in the sutra, this figure Indra is concerned about protecting Prajnaparamita. So it's sort of has a warm feeling to it that this powerful deva is interested in protecting this, maybe really recognizing that there is something of deep value to the teachings. But actually begins by asking Subhuti, I believe. Let's see here. So Indra is asking, when a bodhisattva, Mahasattva, wants to research or investigate the profound Prajnaparamita, how should they investigate it? And Subhuti replies, Kasika or Indra, when a bodhisattva wants to investigate the Prajnaparamita, they should investigate it as space. They should investigate it as emptiness. So this is like Avalokiteshvara practicing deeply, recognizing emptiness of all things. So investigate. We should look closely at what this is, and what this is emptiness. If we want to know what prajnaparamita is, that's what Subhuti is saying. Dogen then brings in a few comments of his own, and he says, we should investigate it as space. So he reiterates that quote by Subhuti. So this is emptiness as the truth of experience. So Dogen's reiterating, investigating this as emptiness is to recognize emptiness as the truth of simple direct experience. So investigate in the sense that if we want to know what daylight is, you know, we could look on Wikipedia or something, but we could just not think about it, and we could actually just pay attention when it's day, when it's daytime. So when it is what it is, then we investigate what it is. And Subhuti is saying that this is actually emptiness, so what we're experiencing is just emptiness. Dogen also says that investigation is space itself. So Subhuti is saying we're investigating emptiness. Dogen is saying that what shows up as investigating is emptiness. So what appears as whatever it appears as, investigating, studying, practicing, that of course is just emptiness. And then Dogen also says space is the investigation of prajna, which is basically the same. And so Indra is wondering how to protect the prajnaparamita. Let's see here. I was going to read that section. I don't know if I have it here. So basically, Subhuti, or Indra is wondering how to protect. And Subhuti is saying that to guard or to protect is just to depend on the perfection of wisdom. So when we depend, you know, it seems like we may need to protect something and guard it against. That's at least Indra's concern here, to preserve it, protect it somehow. Subhuti is saying just depending on the perfection of wisdom is to guard it. So you can see that in a very practical way in the history of Buddhism, that, you know, maybe in India and in China, in Japan, they could have set up some apparatus to try to protect the teachings, you know, make big, you know, impenetrable fortresses to save, you know, the scriptures and so forth, or maybe you come up with a military to guard against invaders. And certainly Buddhism has been in countries where it's been invaded by other forces. It's it's gone through different persecutions in different eras, and actually the protecting of Buddhism is this sincere deep practice of prajnaparamita. So when we depend on and we practice deeply, that itself is guarding. So this is what Subhuti is telling Indra, helping Indra clarify that if you want to protect, that just depend on. And also says, Subhuti says, depending on is to never stray. So, which I think is interesting, because we'll also ask ourselves, how do I not stray from practice? You know, what do I do? What kind of, and there's practical things that we can do to make our practice easier, sort of dedicate to regular schedule and so forth. But Subhuti here is saying that it's probably not good to think about using our personal willpower to try to never stray or like judgment of ourselves. Actually, if we can focus completely on the depending on, to depend on the practice or practice deeply, that is to, as the Buddha says, to guard, and that itself also is to not stray. So it's another image of kind of an at ease or gentle aspect of what practice is that if we just simply do our best to stay with this, that is to guard and to never stray. And this is also in line with what we've been saying all along, too, about the active practice of prajnaparamita, this depending on trusting, not achieving, but trusting or depending on the prajnaparamita. Subhuti says, remember, if all human and non-human beings were looking for an opportunity to harm the prajnaparamita, in the end, it would be impossible. Which is a pretty striking statement, but I think we can probably recognize that that is true. Through the practical aspects of the sincere undertaking of this practice. And then ultimately at the deepest level, there is no such thing as destroying emptiness or destroying reality. There's the notion of doing away is based on confusion, and not that we should not consider harm that can happen in the human world, because it's very important to keep an eye on what we may do to help reduce harm that's happening. To Buddhism, are people who are being persecuted, there's so many different things that we can do where we may want to step in. But here, Subhuti's getting right to the core of it, that it's impossible to destroy what is unfathomable. You can maybe sense this as well with the earth, too, the image of the earth. Think about Indra, the diva of lightning and storms. That lightning that strikes down to the earth, it can start an entire forest fire and destroy, vast tracts of forest. That same lightning will create nitrogen in the water that's in the clouds and come down as fertilizer to replant that forest. So we see this inconceivable quality, this beyond good and bad, actually getting to a deeper understanding of what's happening. So even in these images of nature, we can see sort of ways of understanding that we can go beyond our usual ideas of preserving and destruction and so forth, our limited ways of looking at things. But still, as I was saying, respect and honor how we need to take care of things in a practical way. So Bodhi concludes here and says, if you want to guard the bodhisattva, let's see here. I don't know if I wrote this wrong. So I think Indra is asking also how to guard the bodhisattva. And Subhuti says, if you want to guard the bodhisattva who depends on the profound prajna as thus preached, it is no different from wanting to guard emptiness. It's no different than wanting to guard emptiness. So Indra's concerned about protecting the practitioners too. And Subhuti is gently guiding Indra back to recognizing that to guard the bodhisattva is the same. It's no different than wanting to guard emptiness. So guiding our training our focus back on this picture, this entire picture of the whole body, this picture of what emptiness is. Emptiness in the sense that nothing is frozen or fragmented. Emptiness is this whole body. It could not be solid or frozen.
I'm sorry to interrupt. In that series of quotes, are you? Well, it's not interesting because you know. But is the point that you know there's no way to destroy emptiness. That in a sense. Protection isn't necessary. Is that what
it's pointing to? Yeah. I think in a sense it is saying that the notion of acting in some specific way, no matter what it is, or trying to attribute some kind of scenario to reality, and then from that idea of whatever our scenario is, then we have an impulse to want to do something or something else. Yeah. So it's getting back, I think, Subhuti's helping Indra to move back to a understanding of the practice. This deep practice of prajna is not a practice of trying to do something in order to get a certain outcome, because we're worried about destruction or and I think in the end Subhuti is probably saying that just like the practitioners throughout history have actually protected this through their practice, even in a practical way, we're probably much better equipped to help guard and protect things. Or even maybe if turmoil arises in the world, how do we address that? We could address it out of our, I know what the scenario is, I know what the outcomes are going to be and whatever, and then we act according to our beliefs and so forth, and then when we get in trouble and we exacerbate the turmoil that we perceived in the first point. So it's maybe a little bit too strong, and maybe I said it too strongly about emptiness not being destroyed, or ultimately, yeah, it's like emptiness can't be destroyed. But maybe it's more like our notions of whatever could happen aren't applicable. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks for that question. Probably helps clarify a little bit. So, Subhuti again concludes there here with if you want to guard the practitioners, this is no different than wanting to guard emptiness. So, guiding Indra back to an understanding of what actually is happening. It's not we need to find the people that need to be protected and maybe protect them more than other people. You know, all the problems that we get into. Guarding this is no different than guarding emptiness. So in the end, here with the sutra and the fascicle, I think we're talking about this practicing deeply itself is this perceiving of what is unfathomable, knowing directly. And to guard it is simply to trust or depend on experience itself. So here in session, we have the opportunity to do a activity that's 100%, and we resume that activity continually. And that is not to depend on something like an idea or an idea of what the teachings are or an idea of what prajna paramita is, but this deeply practicing that's talked about in the Heart Sutra is to devote attention to just right what is at hand, which includes the thinking that's arising and ceasing, or the different issues, problems that come up in sitting, to dedicate and take care of what's right in front of us. So that's all I have. I don't know if anybody has any comments or questions about what we've been talking about, or if you've been thinking about anything in particular for the Heart Sutra. It's a pretty incredible piece of teaching. Very.
This was excellent. Really.
Appreciate it.
Illuminated a lot.
Great, thanks.
There's a, on the identity of Avalokiteshvara, Akamura in his living by Bala talks about when he first came to Minnesota Zen Center, he was kind of shocked at the way it was written. That Avalokiteshvara could be saved from all suffering and distress. Because he grew up reading it, I think, Dr. Mungi were, that Avalokiteshvara was not human. This is a being, a magical being. I don't know if you use those terms.
Okay.
And the way this reads, I mean, if it's a magical being, how could it, why would it be saved? So
sure,
the way
yeah.
it reads right now, I saw that Minnesota Zen Center is she passed over suffering.
Oh, okay.
Passed over all suffering. So that's what
okay.
beings can do.
Okay. That sounds nice.
I have a preference, and I really hadn't paid attention to our sutra until I came here, towards Avalokiteshvara being human. Just like Buddha, a person who was enlightened by this practice that we are doing here.
I think so.
But the Dogen is including this. Magical being. I think growing up, what I did, I'm tired of magical beings.
Sure. I know what you mean.
You know?
Yeah.
It is really mature, but I think it's really interesting cultural stuff, but it's kind of quaint.
Yeah.
I can add just one little thing to that. Some of the Buddhist cosmology
can have human-like problems, but they still have some magical stuff going on, you know? So maybe... maybe we're looking at kind of like more of a middle deity as opposed to the head.
It doesn't have an epaulette on its shoulder.
Yeah, it doesn't have a super handshake. Now, I can't say what those... I forget what those layers are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Asuras.
Yeah.
There's one below the Asuras, but yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've probably heard this in the Heart Sutra so many times, but it never, and I won't remember the wording exactly from the Dharma Field version of it, but that Avalokiteshvara clearly sees emptiness.
Perceives, yeah, is it the first, perceive that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress.
And yeah, so she sees, hey, I don't have to worry about this. But given that, then she's attentive to the cries of the suffering of others. She sees for herself, yeah, this isn't what I think it is. But then she's interested in helping others.
Mm-hmm.
It's I don't know, it's an interesting it's not a paradox, but I can imagine in some way myself, not talking about emptiness, but you know, somebody who's worried about something and he's saying, hey, I don't need to worry about that. You know, mm-hmm. in a much less
right,
compassionate,
that's right.
Like you're mistaken. You're mistaken, but I'm still concerned about you.
I
agree.
Like, I think of my kid, where he used to be afraid of things at night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I went through that too when I was a kid, and then I grew up and I realized, well, there's nothing there at all. So, like, when my kid was scared about stuff, I'd be like, hey, I hear you, but let's check it out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to help him realize, dude, there's no boogeyman here. It's all happening up here,
mm-hmm.
You know? So.
If we can only all realize that.
Yeah.
That is part where wisdom and compassion come together in the image of Avalokiteshvara, that understanding or seeing through confusion is wisdom, but then you can't have compassion as something separate. It has to, I mean, it is the same. It is the same thing. So it would be false wisdom to say that, well, I perceive that all five skandhas are empty, and then you're kind of on your own. You know, that is not, that's not seeing the emptiness. Exactly. That's tough to see how wisdom... that it's not possible to see the emptiness of five skandhas and not look down at the world and be completely responsive to the whole picture. But then also Avalokiteshvara is not identifying sources to be solved. This is the full manifestation of Prajna Paramita itself. It's Avalokiteshvara too, to your point there. It's to see the humanness in it is so important, I think. And also maybe the mythical sort of aspect. I've heard it talked about a little bit in terms of myth where it enables us a little bit. Like if it's a mythic or what was the term you used for magical or
magical being.
Yeah, magical being, that the function of that type of storytelling allows us to get a little bit away from literal feel, a literal feel of things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if there's a tradition where the scripture is set, and then if it doesn't fit how it was written, then there's problems, basically. Mm-hmm. So these figures, but then also how we see what it is to be human, too, I think can be loosened, too, in the same way. But we're not saying we're magical either. But that's why the beauty of these sutras really comes out when they are lyrical and poetic in a way, because then they're very responsive. You know, they affect each person a little bit differently and how they're hearing it. And it's very much on the, you know, it avoids the problem of being super literal and, yeah. But now I know your point there. There's with demons and everything else, you know, it's just kind of like we can get pretty wrapped up in what the devil is or something, you know, all kinds of different stuff. So
yeah. Well, in the history of, you know, people thoroughly believing in these things,
mm-hmm.
like in the, so the English hierarchy. It's like, oh, the king, and then his son becomes because they are ordained by God.
Mm-hmm.
So they're controlling the power, the wealth,
yeah.
That sort of thing about people.
Well, yeah, we do that.
Luckily, we're going
to have
that problem here.
Never happened. We would never be in a kleptocracy.
No. Yeah, these problems definitely come up in so many different ways. How a country works, the whole dynamic of it, and then you see sort of microcosms on how personally I may be feeling a sense of wanting to control or worried about what other people think of me and try to take advantage of people. It just shows up in so many different ways. But there's also ways where we can respond with an open heart and you know, with the people around us, that the scenarios that are close to us and that can sort of spread and help too. So, but yeah, the human world is a, what is the phrase? May you live in interesting times. It's like we can't avoid interesting times as being a human. It's just like it's inevitable in some ways, but. Anything else that came up at all? Okay, thank you very much.
This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.